Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Mixed Mental Arts with a guy who sometimes hosts these shows, Hunter Motz. And I'm very pleased to have in the dojo a man that I've now known. How long have we known each other, Tony?
We've known each other 30 years, but it's been approximately 3 years.
Yeah, approximately 3 years, but really emotionally, it's felt like 30 years. And so I should just, you know, to give a little context on Tony Molina. So I got hooked up with Tony Molina originally to help your son Alec with school, but then we ended up having a conversation about culture and about the diffusion of innovations. And we came to realize that you and I have been on parallel journeys, that many of the problems that I've been struggling with in terms of getting educational ideas to move, you've been struggling with the same thing in health.
Yes, you and I are basically teachers of society, just from different ends of the continuum.
Or spectrum, since I've recently been accused of being socially retarded. So crucially, I think that this is a really good example of seeing atomism and holism at work. That's something that we've talked a lot about on this podcast.
Right.
But there's often we hear these things, and, you know, moving out here and being in LA and coming from a scientific background, I would hear a lot about holistic medicine as opposed to Western medicine. And a lot of that stuff is kooky. There's all this stuff where you rub crystals on people, and it's all very woo-woo and auras and chakras and all of that. But as I started to think more and more about these atomistic and holistic perspectives, you see that Western medicine is very atomistic, that it views the body as a series of discrete parts. And it was only with Tony that I started to feel like, oh, wait, the holistic perspective might actually have some value. So would you talk us through one of the things that sort of really blew my mind was the whole thing about back pain and the fact that it might emerge from the foot?
Sure. I think one of the first things about it is people in general have a lot of fear just in general around the body. And they've learned that. They don't necessarily, that's not their experience, but they've learned that. They've modeled that. And then they kind of have risk-averse behavior. So when they get involved in their body, you have something exciting to say.
Well, I was going to say, do we know anybody like that, Tony?
We know somebody like that.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of people have that. Somebody came into the Rewire Project yesterday, a young man trained in the arts of knowledge and science here in our general education process. He has all the information he needs, and he's scared to death because his knees hurt, and he just wants to play his tennis and his basketball. So we started discussing these aspects and the cultural limitation. His parents are both physicians, and they want him to get his x-rays and his MRIs. And so we started discussing it. Why is it someone who's 24 needs to even be thinking about x-rays and MRIs, and why are the knees hurting in the first place? And he was nervous. He's like, well, my knees are hurting. They shouldn't hurt. And why are they hurting just because I've done these sports? He didn't have an understanding. But the parents were very nervous, so they immediately ran him right towards something's wrong with the joints. So we start doing range of motion assessments using the muscle activation technique modality. And he has no movement at all in his ankles to do propulsion.
Well, and a lot of this comes down to the fact that we're animals and that it's weird that you're having all these problems at 24, because clearly in a pre-modern context as a hunter-gatherer, you're not having these problems.
No, you also weren't living that long. So at 24, this guy would be dead in what, maybe 5 to 10 years?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
roughly, right? Predation, starvation, hygiene, medicine, none of those things were there. So you wouldn't be living that long.
Well, I don't know, actually. I mean, if you look, there are a lot of pretty old hunter-gatherers. I don't know we'd have to get Chris Ryan on to sort of really go into what are the mortality rates.
Right.
I think the key thing is that, I mean, Robert Sapolsky has this book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's all about the fact that zebras don't get ulcers. And yet lawyers all along the Wilshire corridor here get a lot of ulcers. I dated a girl who, I think she was like 28 or 29. She'd already had a bleeding ulcer. And I was like, that's not good. And she thought it was perfectly normal. And if anything, that it was a red badge of courage, because like that's how hard and how she worked and how stressed she was and how intense she was, because she'd already earned her first bleeding ulcer at the age of 28.
She was proud.
Yeah, she was on partner track. I think all of this is to say that there are a lot of different cultural beliefs in terms of how we react to the body And I relate to this 24-year-old because I also, if there's anything off about the body, I'm like, oh, shit, I broke it. This is a problem.
Right. So he has a reactive approach, which is generally part of the cultural norm now. So he's, now that his knee's hurt, he thinks he needs to do something about it versus actually taking care of the body, kind of like maintaining a car, and he wouldn't have been in the position in the first place. Now, part of it, actually, it's not his fault because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. So he doesn't understand that he needs to maintain the body because fatigue was normal. He was doing all these sports. The sports created a normal response, which was they got tired. The muscles stopped doing their job. And then he because he doesn't know, he starts to have the symptoms, but the symptoms aren't necessarily that something's wrong. It's just feedback that the muscular system is having an issue.
Right. So this comes down to Hanlon's razor, right? It's not that this guy is a bad guy.
No.
It's just that, like all of us, he's blindly uploaded a certain amount of cultural software.
Yes.
And that drives his choices without him even realizing it. And so his, you know, he has two parents who are physicians.
Yes.
And there's a set of things that you're supposed to do in this situation. So my reaction in that situation is I should stop exercising.
Yes.
You leave it alone and it will fix itself.
Yes.
And then the other reaction is you go do the MRI thing, which firstly, that's super expensive. I can't necessarily afford that. But even let's say he goes to the MRI.
Well, let's go through the process.
Okay.
This is what's important about it. With no judgment. The important part of it is he does the MRI. And the issue is as soon as he's done the MRI, and if it shows something positive, then we immediately have linked that there's something wrong with the joint, and it's quantitative. You see it right there on the report. So immediately that's where the focus then becomes. That's our bias in medicine, is that we look at these things as if they're passive in nature. Mm-hmm. When actually it's active in nature, it means that the reason we got to the point in the first place that the joint is showing up that it has an issue on the MRI or the X-ray, way back up the road, which is why the perspective needs to change, is he didn't do the work to control the stability in the muscular system before the forces weren't being checked. So it went to the joint. It's not discounting what's going on at the joint. The joint itself is having an issue, but nothing's wrong with the joint. The joint is the reaction to the failure that occurred upstream.
And this is where the atomistic and holistic thing comes in.
Yes.
Because Western doctors who are brilliant, well-trained, all of this, but they're going to look at the problem and they're just going to fixate on the knee.
They have to. They're licensed to treat pain.
That's right.
They're going to have to address it. And so generally, the only two choices are generally pharmacology and or a surgery.
But here's where we get into sort of children's songs, which is when I start to feel comfortable and feel like I might know what I'm talking about here, which is the knee bone's connected to the ankle bone,
yes.
Right? Except the knee bone isn't connected to the ankle bone. So apparently I failed even that simple child's test. Because I remember the first time I met you, and I got to be honest, Tony, the first time I met you, I was like very emotionally uncomfortable.
I do that with a lot of people.
Yeah, you make a lot of people emotionally uncomfortable. And actually, I've seen you do it for funsies.
I do it. And the reason that I do it, is there's not necessarily an agenda other than I was in the first Persian Gulf War. I was there for 9 months. And you're in survival. You know, you're not thriving, you're surviving. Most of my interactions with people, they're very intimate relationships. So I'm generally someone that invests in the relationships. I'm not necessarily someone that hangs out and does a lot of small talk. And that's just from those types of years. So I'm quickly right in there in a very deep way with good meaning and intention. But that can be a little bit intense for people when they're looking at, you know, talking about going to get some lunch.
Well, and I mean, firstly, I can relate to that because I have that same boundary pushing Dutch uncle-ness. And I think you're a bit of a Dutch uncle where right. you push boundaries, you are testing. But it's all very well-meaning. But one of the things that I think really helped make sense of why you do that in particular is just that experience of the first Gulf War, where you might have higher-ups who want you to go do a thing, and you want to make sure that logic is really tested out.
Yes.
Because if this is a poorly thought-through plan,
yes.
Then you and your team die.
That's right.
So you better make sure that we're really clear on what we're doing, why we're doing it, that it makes sense, that we have good intel.
Right.
And so that's very much the way that you have then approached medicine, where you're pushing those boundaries and trying to figure out, do we really know? Have we really thought this through? What are we doing? Why are we doing it?
It's challenging because as a lot of other industries, people generally, and they don't even understand why they're doing it, they're immediately already looking for why something won't work. They come in looking like, well, why should I believe this? So you're not really spending time on what it is they need, but it's more really about trying to handle the narrative and convert them so that they relax and then start to see that, oh, I can actually feel good too. And in fact, I should be feeling good. And there's nothing wrong with this at all. That's a cultural aspect that needs to be addressed on a large scale. And it's a big challenge because most people are showing up at the ER room. They're going to the ER, they're going to their doctors for these things that should be handled within the body. And we're not even expecting that they should be happening that way.
Right. And to be fair, I mean, this is, you and I are in a unique position. We have an advantage. And the advantage is that we don't have any privilege to protect within the system.
That's right.
I don't have a PhD. I'm not a professor. I don't have to worry about working within that system and, you know, worrying about risking alienating people. You are not a medical doctor.
No.
So you don't have to play along within the system, and you can ruffle feathers and do podcasts like this in a way that somebody who is perhaps within the system has a lot more social pressure to try and figure out how to have these conversations.
Yes. I mean, it's challenging. Just look at food in just our large city, Los Angeles. People shop at 4 or 5 stores to get their food. You can't just find food. They're at the farmer's market. They're going to 4 or 5 other stores to get their food. And it's a big search to find easy, well, food. It's a bit of a challenge.
Yeah. And so in terms of that sort of holistic perspective, right, just to go back to, so I remember the first time you laid me out on the table, you were saying that, let's say that you have somebody and they go to the doctor with back pain. Well, the doctor is going to look at the back and think that the problem is there. But it's entirely possible that the issue is actually dorsiflexion, right? How the foot moves. And that because the foot isn't able to move properly and absorb these forces, that the forces are being transmitted up and the problem is manifesting in the back.
Absolutely. Most people have limited ankle movement. That's why shoes are designed with a heel, because the manufacturers know that the person doesn't have the ability to get enough movement in the ankle to support even walking, forget running. So then it's just forces going through the system. Let's keep it simple, right? Gravity's acting all the time. It doesn't have any friends, and your body's designed to handle those forces. But you have a skeleton that supports the infrastructure. You have a muscular system that supports these forces. So we kind of look at the skeleton as, well, the skeleton's supposed to handle those forces. It's not. The muscular system's supposed to handle those forces. When it does handle the forces, as we are when we're younger, right? You're in your 20s, you're invincible. The body does great. And that's why we run around and we feel great. And we don't have to think about those things. Then just a little bit of feedback starts, right? You're doing your tennis, you're in college, and then you get a little bit of medial epicondylitis. And there's a little bit of inflammation. It doesn't go away because you're still performing, you're executing, and then you have a compensation. So all of a sudden now we're focused on the compensation, which is a symptom, because way back up the chain, there was fatigue that occurred. So for example, in your back example, many times, most times, not necessarily all times, most times, there's an ankle-related component to it. If not, there's a trunk-related component to it that drove the ankle limitation. So generally speaking, most people have weak feet. Generally. That's because we have the socioeconomic means. You don't have your kids run around without shoes. You throw them in a shoe, right? You can't put a kid into a store without shoes. If we could just have people not wear shoes long enough, we could develop the foot. If you go to Fiji, they have the lowest rates of bunions in the world with low rates of low back pain because their foot looks actually quite disgusting. It looks like elephantitis of the foot. It's gross.
I'm glad we've now offended Fijians and their feet. But that's the thing.
Their function is through the roof.
And that's the key thing, is function.
It's about function.
Does your body do what it's supposed to do, or does it not? And obviously in that paleo environment, in that hunter-gatherer environment, it did what it was supposed to do.
That's right.
So clearly things have happened in terms of culture where now we are living in ways and we are doing things that are making it difficult for us to survive, and all these problems are cropping up, and we have to start wondering, hey, it's the question is not that, you know, sometimes we act as if, oh, there are all these new problems, but the question is, what did we screw up? What are the things that we screwed up between 10,000 years ago and now that are causing all of these problems? And then how do we have a modern society where we're not screwing ourselves up by messing with what was already working?
It's challenging. We were just in Palm Springs this weekend. We were talking about this driving back. We drove from Palm Springs to Los Angeles. It took us 2 hours and 30 minutes. And living in Los Angeles, that's a pretty good time because that could take you 4 hours. But I thought of, we were thinking about it. How long would it take you to go from Palm Springs to Los Angeles before you had the automobile? And would you even end up in Palm Springs? You wouldn't even end up in Palm Springs. So just that alone has changed our entire domain. We have the automobile, right? We have these mass means of transportation. We don't use this frame, this thing we live in, to move around. So mobility itself is as if it's something special, right? You look at people over the fourth and fifth decade of life, their mobility is generally not good. And they're okay with it. They're like, well, this is a normal process of aging. It's not aging. It's just dysfunction. The body's not able to do its job, just like arthritis. It's not necessarily age-related. It's force-related. But we don't look at it that way. That's not the paradigm. We're like, yeah, you're supposed to get the arthritis because the joints are changing, which they do. If you keep the muscular system doing its job, though, the body will do its job.
Well, and crucially, if everyone around you, if you're seeing that happen again and again, where it's like, oh, yeah, it seems like when people get to 50, 60, this is a thing that happens. You assume that this is how it's always been. This is how it's supposed to work. And in fact, that's not necessarily the case.
No.
Zebras don't get ulcers.
They don't.
And so in terms of, because I think that's one of the things that's really interesting and one of what part of what we've been talking about and why you called it the Rewire Project is that much of what you're doing is turning on the body's natural adaptive systems. So the body needs stresses. Needs to be put under stress to be forced to adapt. That's what exercise is supposed to do.
Yes. The challenge with the exercise is most of the stress isn't enough of a stress and or it's too much of a stress. So if you look at exercise, most people exercise for vanity's sake. We know that. They're not exercising for health. You can go to your doctor every year and get your physical and they'll say, oh, they'll look at your blood lipid profile and your cholesterol level and your resting pulse and your BMI. And they might go, well, let's make these changes. And you agree intellectually, but emotionally is where we're driven. So generally you go out there and because of schedule and these limitations in life, it's hard to maintain your exercise schedule. And the exercise drives appetite and reward. So what do you do then with that? Usually you start eating. So generally what you see with exercise is people are gaining weight. And generally what you see with exercise is their caloric expenditure for the investment of time is very low. And that can be really frustrating. So you work really hard in your spin class for 45 minutes. You're anaerobic by metabolism. It means that you can't aerobically produce the energy required to do the demand, which retards and inhibits the process. You drive appetite and reward. You feel great about yourself because it's good. Your circulation goes up. You feel a little bit of endorphin release. You go back home. You have your normal diet, but then in the evening, you need something special to make up for that big, intense session that you did.
See, what I love about this, Tony, is that this is a great example of why innovations don't diffuse. Because you have a lot of knowledge, and I do this too. I mean, when I was on Joe Rogan, I just wanted to share all the knowledge immediately and mention all the books. But that's really the challenge is... Because what's great about our relationship is that I know so much less than you about the body and how it works. And so the challenge is how do you break down all these stories in ways that I can really get?
That's why we're a team.
And that's why we're a team. And I think it's a really good example of why it's so important to have people of different knowledge levels working together. Because what ends up happening is that then together, it's that wisdom emerging between that we talk so much about on this podcast, that out of that, you're able to shape what are the narratives that are really going to help bring people up the adoption curve.
People want to feel good.
Yeah.
You'd agree?
Yeah.
Do you agree that people don't want to think about the topic we're describing?
Well, it's emotionally uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable, right? So these are things that are necessary and they can be and should be exciting and things that we can be compelled about.
Well, and I think that's when you get way up the adoption curve, then that's what that experience changes to. But if we look at, let's take me as a test case.
One more thing with it. Why do you think there's such a big adoption curve that's needed right now in society?
I think because we're at a state of obliviousness. And it is that Hanlon's razor where, you know, I go out and, I mean, in terms of education, I go out and I say things, and it's a lot of stuff that people haven't even thought about. And then, you know, part of it is then the experience as the communicator. Like, I just ran into a guy, very nice guy, at the place where I was having a little spot of breakfast before I came over here. And, you know, it's I've had this conversation a million times. But then you are like, oh, I have to go into my spiel again. So, and you, you know, on a selfish level, you kind of are just like, I've heard this, I've heard me say my own spiel so many times, I don't want to say my own spiel anymore. So I just kind of want to rush through it. But you also know that if you don't do it properly and hit all the beats and really set it up, that it's not going to be effective, and it's going to be a waste of your time and their time. So the challenge is that it really takes a lot of unpacking to bring anybody up the adoption curve on literally any idea. I mean, that's what the diffusion of innovations is about. And part of it is that at a certain point, you've done that spiel so much that now what you want to do is you want to shape the content, the videos, the blogs, the memes, the books, so that you can easily, rather than like re-unpacking it verbally every single time, you can just be like, here, watch this 2-minute video, here. Here's a book. Go read the book. And then the person reads it or doesn't read it, but at least you have a better return on both of your time in terms of investment.
I think the difference between you and I is you actually care that they get it.
Yeah.
I don't really care that they get it.
Well, but if you want to actually change the system, you have to help them get it.
I don't think I want to change the system. I think that the easier way to do it, and I really believe it, is because people, they generally are just gonna, they're driven by pain. They don't want to have pain. Pain, just however that works for them, metaphorically, literally, physically, they're driven by that. So generally they end up needing, they need these services or this viewpoint. They need to make this paradigm change, and they end up having no choice, unfortunately, once it's too late. And I'm not wishing that on people. It's just, it's a little bit easier though if you had a room full of people or a stadium room full of people in all kinds of despair with all these mechanical issues and structural issues and on medicines, they would do much better because of their cultural, what they've gone through in culture, versus trying to convert people one by one. And that seems to be the challenge, is one by one, people have a hard time doing this conversion.
I think certainly once people have sort of hit bottom, right?
Right.
Like when people have hit bottom, it becomes very easy to convert them. So it's not a surprise to Katie and me that that we've had good resonance with the Straight A Conspiracy with prisoners, because for them, it's incredibly clear. Right. Oh, I didn't get this education. I didn't know how to teach myself. So I ended up here. So now you want to do something different. But I personally, with the children of the world, do not want to have them all end up in prison
right
before they understand how to teach themselves and how to learn. And I think that all of these concepts can be broken down in such a way that they are so accessible that people get up the adoption curve and get them up much more quickly. Because the problem is also for you, Tony, is that let's say that you that stadium full of people with all those medical problems, that exists. There's many stadiums full of people with yes. medical problems. But the problem is that most of them don't even know that there's an alternative. They don't know that Tony Molina exists. And so in the ecosystem of people with different understanding, you're going to have some people who are going to who understand it and are living this way before they have problems. You're going to have some people who are essentially Saul, who has become Paul, where they were, you know, in pain, had this terrible experience, and then you showed them a better path, and then they will go out and convert for you. And you're going to have people all along the spectrum. There's going to be a huge, huge range of people. But you need to get these ideas. And some people, by the way, will endlessly talk about you and what you do without ever applying it. But they're still promoting and moving those narratives and those ideas.
It seems like the best way it works currently for people is not to even address and go around discussing it this way with their health, their function, because generally people don't take the emotional decision from that. They do, though, get excited when they start to look at if they are starting to feel alive and compelled. So as people move towards being investing in themselves for their own mastery of what they're doing in their life, that then can play out. And then as a byproduct, they can then have the health gains as the byproduct instead of going towards the health gain.
Well, I think that's, yeah, health gain, I think, for most people, I mean, speaking for myself, you know, in my Pillsbury Doughboy state, which I'm recovering from. But that's just such a remote goal. Like, it's not, you know, the idea of being fit and health gains and thinking about, oh, how will my heart be working and how will my arteries be in 30, 40 years? It's so far away for most people. It's people don't think on those sorts of timelines with their health.
Sure. There's nothing exciting about that.
Yeah. And I mean, to be a better old person, there are people who get excited about that, but the majority of us,
you want to live now.
That's right. And yeah. And living now means, oh my God, delicious thing. Let's eat that pastry. Let's eat whatever it may be. So I think it's going to be a whole series of narratives, and different people will resonate with different narratives. But one of the things that I've picked up from you that I certainly appreciate and that works well in education and that I appreciate in terms of my health is that mastery path. It's moving from an ego orientation to a mastery orientation. And I've been there for a while with my learning, but have not been there with my health. And you've been helping to switch me onto that mastery path.
We had five people walk in from a large bodybuilding environment here yesterday into the Rewire Project. They got exposed to biodensity. These were bodybuilders with mesomorph skeletons, large frame, big bone people with a significant amount of muscle. And they looked at that biodensity, didn't make any sense to them, right? Which is this, you know, simple 5-minute loading process to drive the skeleton to make a bone density change. So I got on the unit to show them what the bone density unit looks like so they can experience it. And they looked at me, and I'm not large by any nature, my frame, and I produced a 3,000-pound leg press on the unit. And I said, you guys need to sit down and do this leg press. And these are guys that I don't know what their general force production is. Generally, it's pretty high as they're moving the weights. So they sit down, and these are five people. All five people were under 2,000 pounds of loading, and they couldn't understand it. And it was a real paradigm shift. And we had to discuss function and health versus just this ego orientation that you're describing.
So, bro, even if you lift, you may not be doing the right thing. And I think the biodensity is such a great example in terms of what Rewire does and how we're turning you on in terms of the tissues here. So let's talk about this biodensity. So it comes out of, I think, this is how I've been sort of starting to grasp it and starting to make sense of it. So we all know that when astronauts go into space, that they lose bone density, right?
Yes.
Their bones become, they essentially have osteoporosis and osteopenia,
right?
Because they're in space, their bones are not under pressure, they're not under the force of gravity, and therefore the osteoblasts, the bone cells, are not getting the signal they need to turn on increasing bone production.
That's right.
And then they come back, and there are all these great photos of cosmonauts who are in space for excessively long times. You know, they used to send the astronauts up for short periods of time, but the Russians would be like, yeah, send them in space, leave them there for a little while. It's cheaper if we leave them up there for a year.
Right.
And so they would come back, and they would literally be sitting in these lawn chairs, unable to even move or lift their own arms.
Yeah, that's significant atrophy.
And so how did this biodensity thing, this machine, evolve?
It's crazy. It evolved because somebody's mother was diagnosed with osteoporosis, and she was in her 70s, and they were like, well, there has to be a way with, you know, all our technology, there has to be a way to address this without necessarily just medicine, because there's a bunch of potential downsides to taking the medicine for bone density. So they started to figure out that we could produce the greatest forces isometrically. So what if we were to create an isometric loading platform that allows the skeleton to load to improve the skeleton density, and they could do that in a one-stop shop.
And what does isometrically mean?
That means no movement occurs. So you generate the greatest forces without any movement occurring. So the joints are under compression.
So it's like me pushing against a wall.
You're standing there pushing against the wall. You're trying to push the car. Hmm. Could you push a car and make it move?
No.
If you got it moving, if you pushed hard enough, long enough, and you overcame the coefficient of friction, would the car eventually move? It would. Because you can generate the greatest forces because the car is so heavy, more recruitment occurs. So it's brilliantly simple. So because the biodensity, there's no movement that occurs, we recruit the greatest amount of percentage of fibers for the 5 seconds of loading each movement that you do.
So we're that's so when you're talking about recruiting, you're talking about making all the tissue work.
Right. It's an all or none response. So that's generally why exercise is a little limited, because we don't reach these thresholds to drive the system, because the body's trying to figure out how to stay efficient.
So let's talk about these thresholds. So the analogy that I've been using to make sense of it is the analogy of skin. I am pale. as a pale man, when I go out into the sun, my skin picks up these signals, picks up this UV radiation, it detects that. And then there's a signal, a biochemical signal, to upregulate melanin production. So my skin produces pigment and I tan.
And you need your sunglasses off to pick that up through your eyes. So if you have your sunglasses on, you're actually limiting the process. So if you're in the Midwest and you step outside to get your UV and you've got those sunglasses on.
Is that true?
You've just limited your UV uptake.
Really?
So then should they potentially be going to tanning booths in the Midwest?
I don't know.
Tick-tock. Potentially. There could be an actual driver need for people that have limited exposure, plus they already have that complexion, to be out there just getting a little light dose to turn on that, just get that threshold turned on so the body can process with cholesterol and make vitamin D production.
So, the point is the body picks up these environmental signals.
Yes.
And then rewires itself. It turns itself on and changes what the tissues are doing. So what this biodensity machine does is the same thing. The real point of this isometric exercise is to send a pressure signal, a force signal, onto the bones so that the bones basically get turned on and increase bone density.
Yes, you're bypassing the muscular system. You're using the muscular system with maximal force generation that you induce. There's nothing that's loaded on you. And you're trying to create compression across the joints. And that compression is happening because you're loading with no movement. So the greatest forces can occur. Then slight agitation actually occurs on the bone. There's actually slight tears occurring on the bone. That's what drives the growth in the bone. Just like if you were a martial artist and you were hitting over and over and over, the bone itself grows, it hypertrophies. And that's a good thing when you're trying to load the bone, because that's how density is created. So we're getting the benefits of high impact exercise while minimizing most of the risk of high impact exercise.
No, and we're minimizing the risk because
it's no movement.
Right.
You induce the load. No load is placed on you. Control as easiest as possible because all of it is seated other than one movement that's standing. And all the degrees of freedom you have to control are sequentially handled because of the machine is set up just for you to load those four movements.
So we're able to go to higher forces because that no movement means that I'm not throwing out my back, trying to lurch the thing into movement, lurch the weight into movement, and then, you know, lurch it back down.
You're removing most of the control, essentially, and you can focus just on the gain.
That's right. Yep. And so, and to use a clumsy analogy, what this is like is it's like a tanning bed for your bones.
That's right.
It's a very specific targeted signal that is designed to produce a particular result.
It's brilliant. It's simple. It's 5 minutes. There's four movements and you're pushing twice, you're pulling twice. And, you know, generally speaking, most people actually can't start loading bone effectively that we see here at Rewire because they've already got all these musculoskeletal components, right? Disorders, whatever it is. There's a weakness somewhere going on in the chain. So they sit down and do this great modality, which is a medical device, and they have to build up over the course of a couple weeks or months to reach these thresholds so that the bone response actually occurs. That's not a problem. It just is a process because they have to be able to generate enough force so that enough multiples of body weight has occurred so that the bone actually gets the response.
Now, I know that for many people, I mean, I shared some of what you guys do here with Mark Schatzker, who wrote The Dorito Effect, who's been on the show, and he and I have been corresponding. It's like, because he's been reading the blog posts that I've been writing about some of this stuff. And he's like, does this really work? Like, what's the data? Does this all add up?
We're back to the atomistic holistic
exactly.
aspects.
Exactly. Right. And we start to, it starts to feel nervous and uncomfortable because it doesn't fit culturally with what we know.
It's great. We had a doctor here a couple of weeks ago. He walked in, he had his arms crossed across his chest, and immediately he was like, prove to me this works. And I said, you need to walk back out the door and let's start again. He's like, what'd you just say? I said, you need to walk back out the door and let's start again. It has nothing to do with you figuring out if it works for you. This works. This is how the body's designed. All we're doing is overloading the skeleton at least 4.2 multiples of your body weight, which is the minimum threshold to start driving bone growth.
That is, by the way, the crazy thing is that in order to get that response from your osteoblast, there is this threshold. You have to hit 4.2 times your body weight or you're not getting that. So when you see these little old ladies who have osteopenia and osteoporosis, and they're very often walking around with the pink lady dumbbell weights.
That's right.
And they're not doing anything. They're just wasting their time. They're not getting the gain because they're not getting up to the kind of forces that they need. And I think what's interesting, too, is it Lee and his company that does biodensity and power plate?
Yeah, Performance Health Systems.
Right. And so Lee, who I've now met through you, is a very nice guy, but very much the mindset that they're in, because they don't know about the diffusion of innovations, is that they just need to build up more and more scientific data. And if they just build up enough scientific data, then that's really what's going to get this thing adopted.
That's right.
The more empirical evidence they can build up, then we'll really get there. And the point is that you and I, knowing the work of people like Everett Rogers and knowing about Richard Nisbet and atomism and holism and knowing about how culture works from Joe Henrich, know that that's not what it's going to take. It's going to take storytelling, and it's going to take telling narratives and stories that allow people to engage with this. And that's part of why we've also started to focus on talking about people. I don't know if we haven't talked to them about using their names. So let's just say JC, which is not Jesus Christ.
Okay.
But JC had a problem. She was also very skeptical, very quantitative, and she really wanted to. She was like, I don't know, biodensity, but she had some bone density issues.
Yeah,
right?
She went to get her normal or annual checkup physical. They did a DEXA scan, and the DEXA scan showed that she not just had osteopenia, the beginning of bone loss, quantitatively, that she had osteoporosis. And so that means that for years she's been losing bone, but just now that there's enough loss, they can quantify it as she fits in the osteoporosis category.
And how old was she?
She was around 50 when she got the diagnosis.
And so, but I mean, you know, to give her credit, right? I mean, this is not what you're getting when you go to your doctor. You're getting, oh, you need to take a pill. You need to. I mean, whatever that is, you know, take more calcium, whatever. I mean,
what did they tell her to do when they gave her that? No, on her own, she sought out the biodensity apparatus. She was at a Tony Robbins conference. They have the biodensity units at the conference. And so she was exposed to it, didn't understand it. But because she linked her DEXA scan to the apparatus, the biodensity, she was like, I need to do this. So then she found the Rewire Project through her time at the conference.
But she's empirical, so she gets her DEXA scan first, so she knows what she's where she is, and then she starts showing up. And how often is she doing this?
She shows up like she's going to church. Once a week she shows up and she does her biodensity.
That's great. The Church of Biodensity.
That's right.
And so and she does this once a week, and how often is she for how long?
It takes her 5 minutes.
5 minutes, but how many months does she have to do it over?
She needs to do it. Generally, building bone is roughly a year process, depending. If you have really, really high-level osteoporosis, then you should plan it's going to take you longer. It's not a bad thing. You don't have to take any medicine. It takes you 5 minutes once a week. Like, it's brilliant. So for her, it was about a year process.
But the key thing is, I think, you know, in terms of part of it is that when you say it only takes 5 minutes, people start to think this sounds a little bit infomercially, but it takes 5 minutes for a year, every week of the year. And it's a real commitment. Like, it takes work to rebuild bone.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're driving bone. I mean, look at just, you're talking about the pink lady dumbbell. So you see, you know, women generally like to walk up stairwells. I'm not sure why, because they build bigger butts and bigger thighs. So if you want to build bigger butts and bigger thighs, women, ladies, then go hit the stairwells. But generally, women don't want bigger glutes and bigger quads. They want to look leaner, and they want to look the value proposition is different. Yes. So the descriptor is not that they want to be bigger. So they're not driving bone density, though, are they? Because they're just walking. So when you walk, you don't drive enough multiples of body weight through the skeleton to elicit the response to induce bone growth. So you're
not getting to that 4.2 times.
You're not making that threshold.
Right.
So here are all these people walking around doing these things, and they're not doing that.
It's like if you wanted to get a tan, but you were doing it by hanging out in, indoors all day.
That's right.
And you're like sitting there, you're underneath your halogen light, and you're like, oh my God, I'm doing so much. I'm tanning. But you're never reaching the threshold that actually turns on melanin production.
No. So Jennifer was walking as well, up and down hills, and she was like, well, I'm working hard. She's feeling that effect of gravity. I'm going up the hill, but she wasn't reaching the 4.2 multiples because she's just walking. You'd have to run to do that, and you'd have to run downhill to do that.
Because crucially, when you're running, you're getting more impact.
Yes.
And usually, that's, again, to
if
go back...
If you're running efficiently enough to reach the number, because most people don't actually run, they jog, or what I call, they shuffle. And the society shuffle doesn't involve enough impact to drive density. It just uses the skeleton and creates a lot of dysfunction and a little bit of early degeneration.
The degree to which this is like education, in the sense that so many people are going through the motions and then congratulating themselves and patting them on the back for having gone through the motions, and then they're pissed off, why am I not getting the results?
I just used to drive down PCH on the highway with a big sign. I'd be yelling out the window, just go get your coffees, go to the library, go see the movies. It's just better than what they're doing because they're just kind of wasting time.
That's right. And so what this all requires is being much more intentional and thoughtful about understanding how the system works so that you can produce the results that you want. But again, none of this is malicious. None of this is, it's mostly just cluelessness, right? It's that Hanlon's razor. It's a certain level of obliviousness.
Right.
And, I think what's interesting too is that having dated somebody who was pretty into fitness, there is just an obsessive doing stuff.
Absolutely.
And that's so much of what the fitness industry is. And you're not necessarily thinking about what am I trying to achieve? What are you trying to achieve with your goals? And I think particularly this community is, or at least the mixed martial arts community is a good community for that. Because it's interesting, even now starting to take some of these kickboxing. I take these kickboxing classes at a CrossFit gym, and there's this weird tension between the guy who teaches the kickboxing and the CrossFit gym, because he sits there and he's talking about functional fitness the whole time. And then is like, you guys are doing all this crazy CrossFit stuff. Like, it makes no sense. What do you want? Like, these people can't even move. They have no range of motion, very much the sorts of things that you're saying, but he's in that space.
Let's talk about it for a second. The CrossFit thing. And to start off, we generally look at all the things we do in compartments, right? So everything has a language, right? Look at computers. We have a language for computers and how you describe it, right? You look at every category, we have these categories. And so with CrossFit, it goes immediately into a category, right? So it's Olympic level type weightlifting. That's what you're doing. There's nothing wrong with that. That's great. You can build bone density that way. The challenge is you have to generally be between 19 and 25 to do pretty well, because you're really relying on a significant amount of control, and generally the body gets tired. So it's not necessarily reproducible or sustainable for most of us, because we are going to need a lot of maintenance to maintain it. So the benefit of it is great if you're looking just at a bone density perspective, because the numbers are going to be high. You're going to reach that minimum threshold every time because the numbers are high. But how long can you sustain it? Not long. The body's going to need to compensate. So it's not synonymous with health. Sport isn't synonymous with health. And that's kind of what's going on with that and a bunch of other categories, is people are going to these fitness trends and they're not reaching their goals because they can't sustain it because it wasn't sustainable in the first place.
Well, and crucially, they're not reaching their goals because they haven't acquired the sufficient understanding to even think about, okay, what are my goals? Being reflective about it and then thinking about, am I taking the sorts of actions that are setting me up for that? Because, for example, you've talked about, so compensation is a word you use a lot.
Right. So to come back to Jennifer. Right. So Jennifer was compensating. She was doing things like CrossFit, thinking, I'm going to load my structure heavy enough to induce bone growth. Great. That sounds great. She's a ectomorph type skeleton. That's a thin person who doesn't have a lot of density in bone, right? Now she has the osteoporosis mechanism as well. So bone is frail. So she was there. She lasted one session and her body was completely not able to sustain that because she can't support or control it.
And she wasn't fit enough to be able to operate at that level. I mean, that's so much of the problem of CrossFit is that people go in who aren't in the kind of shape they necessarily need to be in order to do the CrossFit, even if they could.
This is like talking about religion and which God's better. So now we have to talk about it. So, so fitness for something like CrossFit, fitness doesn't have, it's not a descriptor in the discussion in the first place. So when you're doing any kind of Olympic level type weight training, the energy system that's used isn't an energy system that can supply energy long enough to handle it.
So you're talking about anaerobic and aerobic.
Yes.
So now you're in my biochemistry territory. Now I'm feeling better, right? Now I'm starting to really track it. So
if we looked at every single person that walks into these gyms to do those types of workouts, if I was at the door, we would let in one in maybe 1,000 people to do it from an energy metabolism standpoint, because we're promoting not necessarily the best energy system for health. We're supporting the disease energy system, the one that drives a lot of our diseases, the anaerobic system.
So let's break this down. So everybody has an anaerobic respiration system and an aerobic respiration system.
You sprint across the street to get to the train before you miss it. You're in Europe. That's your anaerobic system. You don't need oxygen for that.
Right. And so
short-term fuel, short-term energy production, then it gets fatigued easily.
And then what happens is that's when you start to get that last lactic acid buildup and you get the stitch.
Right. Legs get heavy. We get a side stitch. We have to pant. We have to pause. It's not sustainable for long periods.
Whereas the aerobic system is a sustainable system that you can be producing for ages and ages.
We have over 100,000 calories of storage in our body. You can go all day. You can go for days.
Right. And so when you see people who do, for example, those endurance hunts where they run for hours and hours, or people who do ultra marathons, that's them being in their aerobic system and being able to sustain that.
Yeah, most of their energy production is coming aerobically. There's always a contribution from both energy systems all the time. It's an all-in-one response, right? The body doesn't really care what you or I think. It's just handling metabolic demand.
But so, for example, if we go back to, so much of what many of us are doing is that we're just sort of working out and we're doing stuff and we're, you run, you go on the treadmill, you do this. But what you can be doing is reinforcing that anaerobic system.
That's mainly what's going on in society is the anaerobic system is dominant and is being reinforced through exercise.
So if we go back to people on the podcast who don't necessarily read my blog posts, which, by the way, are getting better, they're less 5,000 wordy and more relatable. But there's one that I did about when I first moved out here. I was the 24-hour fitness cheerleader in their ad campaign. And so during this time, I was actually using 24-hour fitness, not paid for by them. I had separately signed up. And there was this bizarre experience where I would do the elliptical, I would crush the elliptical, I put it on the highest setting, and I just do it for 45 minutes, an hour, or something like that. But on the stairs on the way up to the gym, I would be out of breath. And this really suggests a real problem, because the machine is this very specific thing. You sort of get really good at the machine, but it's not real fitness. You're not really able to perform. And it doesn't take long before my body switches, is just like purely stuck in the anaerobic system.
Most people have never truly developed themselves, their bodies. So that's really what we're getting to here is it's not that what people are doing necessarily is bad as much as they never really truly get to develop. They're always kind of on the outside looking in, hoping that the things they're doing are going to make the gain so they can support their self-medication of their massive intake of calories, which that's a separate discussion. And so then they need to make a development gain, but they're not necessarily either don't have the time to make the development gain, don't have the means to make the development gain because life is so impacted. And when they do their whatever they're doing, it's not necessarily development. It's like a shock stimulus to the body. Shock stimulus doesn't make the aerobic system develop. And that's what we need to get people to do, is to make the aerobic system dominantly developed.
Right. And crucially, people don't have even a way of thinking about these things. I think that's the key thing, is We don't have a way of thinking about the aerobic or the anaerobic system, or thinking about bone density, where, oh, we're trying to create this very specific stimulus, and, oh, weightlifting may not be the most effective way to target the osteoblasts. So there's just a lot of knowledge, I think, because obviously we can't, it's one thing in terms of doing this podcast. What can we transmit effectively on this podcast? We can transmit the knowledge, and we can start to give people ways of thinking about this, and we can disseminate that knowledge. And that knowledge is the foundation of then being able to make better choices, the wisdom to know the difference, so that you can be a smarter shopper in terms of your fitness choices, your health choices. And that's a large part of what we're going to be doing in our ongoing conversations, is breaking down how to even think about fitness and how to even think about health.
To finish with JC, so she's over 150% stronger than day one on biodensity. Her bone density DEXA scan after a year of biodensity went from osteoporosis level back to osteopenia level and back to normal levels.
So it works.
It works. She's not the only one.
And she's not the only one. I mean, that's we're making this a singular story so that people can relate to it. But the point is that Lee and all of his buddies over at Biodensity, they build up endless empirical data.
There's plenty amount of data that's out there.
And it's still not diffusing. And of course, what's interesting is that the people who have most resonated with these ideas are the Chinese. There's this huge, huge study that's going on in China around biodensity, and it's hardly a surprise that they get it because, of course, they think holistically. They think of the body as a connected system, and so they understand that you can't just sort of look in terms of, oh, we're going to replace the knee, oh, we're going to, you know, put in this drug. They understand that you have to stimulate the whole system in order to produce the kind of gains that you want.
Yes. In China, they have the highest rates of diabetes in the world. So they're dealing with, you know, they have a high wine intake, their white rice intake, the biodensity, which is also interestingly exciting. When you do biodensity consistently, you make more insulin receptors. So you can affect blood sugar sensitivity just from doing the biodensity. So the largest currently going research on diabetes is happening at a couple of the hospitals in China with the biodensity modality. And that's ongoing right now, which is big work going on.
Right.
Huge.
And so part of this is that there's real opportunity here to make really, really big changes in very non-invasive ways.
Yes.
To create a healthier, and, you know, more affordable health system.
Yeah. And then these things need to be available. You know, they need to be at, you know, all the bus stops and the train stops, and it should be free.
Yeah.
And the government should fund it. And then you would just get your biodensity stimulus before you get on the train.
Now that starts to sound like communism, Tony. And I don't know that we can get behind that sort of socialist rhetoric. I mean, if Brian Callen finds out that people on his podcast, because yes, this is Mixed Mental Arts, but let's be clear that Emperor Callen runs the show here. He's a very remote ruler. He's far away, always watching, always judging.
Long reach,
exactly. So, you know, when we talked about, there's this Chinese saying, heaven is high and the emperor is far away. Right. The emperor is Brian Callen, and he is always far away, but he's very much involved. He's always present. And, you know, Brian has a very particular emotional reaction around any time that anybody starts talking about a government program. He's very nervous because his dad, Big Mike, was a cold warrior. And so there's just a certain emotional association there.
We can stroke his back and help him relax.
I don't know that I would stroke Big Mike's back. You might lose a finger. Although, actually, you know, given your own, I think he was in the Marines too.
Okay.
So, you know, you guys could do that. Maybe that creates a permission space where you guys can stroke each other's back.
Right.
But that whatever the mechanism ends up being, private or public, there's a lot of these techniques that need to move, and a whole other way of interacting with and thinking about our health to create a sustainable and healthy system, both in terms of the body and in terms of the healthcare system. And a lot of what this comes down to, I think what's super helpful in thinking about this stuff, is the old Ben Franklin thing that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And our healthcare system currently is pounds and pounds of cure and very, very little prevention.
Yes.
And none of this is to say that anybody here, doctors or patients or, you know, the 24-year-old guy or Jennifer or me or you, are bad people. It's just that we've obliviously uploaded this culture, and doctors are human, And our medical system is called Western for a reason. And you just have to look at the structure of what happens. You go to a GP, yep. and then the body's broken up into all these parts. It's atomistic. And then you're sent to a specialist who deals with that. But as we said, the knee bone is connected to the leg bone. See, I got it right this time.
Everything's great. Our job is just to start addressing our bodies before we need those specialists. Because when we need those specialists, we have the best medicine in the world. We just need to understand that we can take on this body thing and also have our expectation that it can do its job. And if we do that work, then we won't need to be using those services. That in alone is its own massive thing as we unload the healthcare system.
Right.
We could be unloading our healthcare system just from making these changes culturally.
So, and then as we reduce the stress on the system, then it all becomes much more affordable.
Yes.
Becomes much more accessible. So it's a win-win for everyone. But I think so much of it is that, again, a lot of this just comes down to moving these ideas and better ways of thinking.
Yes.
Well, Tony Molina, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, buddy.
We'll be back again.
We will be back again. And I also think that people would really benefit from hearing some of your Marine Corps experiences, but I think they'd also really appreciate some of your adventure racing experiences.
There's plenty of those to go on.
Yeah. So just briefly, give us a little taste of, so after you did the Marine Corps, you got into this adventure racing thing. So tell us about that.
Well, I was, you know, most of us, I would say, would love to be a professional athlete at some times in our life. So my stint at being a pro athlete was to do these expedition races. And it was fantastic. It was utterly, just devastatingly, brutally hard.
Are some of the things that you were doing brutally hard?
I got to be in the what would be called the unconventional Olympics. We would cross entire countries with non-motorized modes of transportation. So in Morocco. So in Morocco, we were riding camels for 50 kilometers. Then we were co-steering up and down the coastlines. Then we were ocean paddling down the Barbary Coast. And then we were climbing and hiking and trekking through the Atlas Mountains.
And what you told me that one time you were doing it for 24 hours of kayaking?
Well, those races, all of them were nonstop over 8 to 10 days, 24 hours a day. So you're going straight for a week. You're losing, you know, significant amount of poundage in your body, and you're surviving. And you're with a team of people, and you're orienteering across the land, and I was, you know, one of the people doing the navigation, and you're fully on, and you're never so alive, though. You're never so alive. So you get really efficient at understanding that this thing we live in needs to run really well, and we have to take care of it. So my intuition of taking care of my feet and my stomach started from those expedition races, because you had to take care of your feet, because otherwise you couldn't walk. Forget everything else you want to do, and you would generally get trench foot, and generally have, you know, you could have, you know, your nerve endings exposed and intense blisters, and you had to manage that and still be competitive. You had to manage your gut so you wouldn't get sick, because you're in another country. You have to eat the right things. So maintaining gut health and maintaining your feet became a real key. When you're racing 24 hours a day for a week nonstop, crossing all these crazy terrains, you know, you start to understand that nothing is really more important than this thing we live in. And when you press it to that level, you can just see how well it actually responds, because it can actually take that level of stress and actually it'll adapt to it. At the end of, let's say for 10 years I did those races, 1 to 2 times a year. In the middle of that five, let's say at year five, I could recover from one of those races, 500 to 600 kilometers of nonstop movement, 24 hours a day, 7 to 10 days nonstop. I could recover and be ready to do another one, physically and emotionally, in as little as 6 weeks.
That's pretty cool.
That's adaptation. Mm-hmm. Separate from my incessant need to try to push myself as an athlete, just the fact that the organism could adapt, not just physically, it would recover, but emotionally and mentally, which is a huge aspect of that, because it was so hard to push like that. But that it could adapt that fast to that much of a rigorous type of load was absolutely crazy to have that experience.
And that's not an experience, to your point earlier, that's not an experience that most of us ever have. Most of us never really find out what our bodies can do. We're just sort of on the outside looking in.
Yeah, I got to really define what it means to move. And in doing that, it's changed my perspective and my own paradigm on how we look at, like, this body thing. So separate from my educational background, separate from my own opinion on it, my experience from having had to rely on my body at such a in-depth primal level and seeing what it can do and how it does it and how well it handles these things. I understand it empirically, I understand it emotionally, and I understand it experientially that, yes, it's supposed to be able to do these things. It doesn't mean you need to go race 24 hours a day for a week, but it's supposed to be able to handle these normal things that we're dealing with in life.
To me, that's the emotional core of why you've made this your life's work, because you know what the body can do, and you see that most people have never found that out. They've never had that experience, and you want to share it.
Yeah, you want people to have that feeling so they can understand, oh my gosh, like, it's amazing just to be alive.
Yeah.
And they can connect to it, and then they can end their quest for searching for the right exercise class or the right thing that's going to make them feel good. They leave the constraints of the health and fitness industry, and they can actually then have what they want. And that's exciting. And isn't that what we want? We want that feeling, that tangible necessity.
The feeling of being alive.
You want the feeling and the experience of being alive. That's how you'll get it.
Rather than just, I mean, there's this great line in Point Break when Bodhi, played by Patrick Swayze, the big sort of surf guru, says...
The original Point Break.
Yeah. I go back to the text. But in the original Point Break, where he talks about all these people, you know, shuffling along the freeways in their metal coffins, and that they don't know what it means to be alive. Now, this doesn't mean that you should get a bunch of ex-presidents' masks and go rob banks, but the experience of being alive, and I think particularly physically alive, is not one that I've had, and I'm 35. And then you take me out there and have me doing things like rock climbing and ice climbing and climbing mountains. We're talking about maybe doing Kilimanjaro at the end of this year. And it is well outside of my comfort zone. I'm much more comfortable with a bunch of books and reading and talking and doing all of that.
When you're laying there dying, the thing you're going to be thinking about is not how much more work could I have done? It's what are those experiences you're going to take with you?
Yeah. And let me tell you that when Tony, you know, screams you up an ice wall, and then you're clinging to that ice wall for dear life, it does make you really alive. I mean, the rock climbing experience and the ice climbing experience in particular, because that fear takes over and you get real dialed in on what's right in front of you. And then you're forced to manage your own emotions and pull out and sort of think strategically and think about move by move. And it's actually funny, the second to last podcast I did was with another Marine Corps alum. Okay. And he was talking, he started using all these great Marine Corps phrases like embrace the suck. and then he had some other ones, but you know, I think it was adapt the fire or fire and adjust or something like that. But I think that experience that you guys have shared is so much of it in terms of being really present and really alive. And I think that certainly civilians like myself could benefit from a lot of that.
We do our best work when we are under just a little bit of threat.
Yeah.
The body can pool its best resources. So just a slight, just a little bit of a dose of that, and we do really well.
Yeah.
The human organism just steps right up.
We should be at the edge of our abilities. And so I can't resist. I really want you to tell the swim test story.
Which one? In for reconnaissance?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that, I don't know if it's changed now. I'm sure they always change it. Like I had the record on the Navy SEAL obstacle course down in Coronado, California. That's years ago. So I'm sure by now someone's, you know, beat that record. So when I first went into reconnaissance, they shipped us from Hawaii to Coronado, and the training was supposed to start on Monday. On Friday, they said, you need to report to the pool. And, okay, so you report to the pool. It's Friday. You're thinking, okay, you have the weekend. You're going to rest. You know this huge, massive, formal process is about to start on Monday for several months. You're hoping to survive that. So Friday, I show up to the pool. I'm thinking, okay, there's just some logistical thing. I don't know, filling out forms, checking uniforms. Maybe they're going to pass out gear. So I show up at the pool, and they're like, get in the pool. And we're all there, all the people that are supposed to start the course. So we jump in the pool. Now we're in our normal fatigues, right? Our, you know, boots, our camouflage gear. So we jump in the pool. And that jumping in the pool began a 12-hour quest to see who actually was going to get to start the training on Monday. So for 12 hours all night in that pool, your job was to survive, to demonstrate if you were actually trainable.
And so you're treading water for 12 hours.
You're surviving in the pool for 12 hours. Yeah. You're not just treading water. You're hanging onto someone's shoulders and pushing them under the water so you can get up to get a breath. And that person, you know, has an underwater blackout, and they pull that guy out. The paramedics are there. They're reviving him on the side of the pool. Your eyes are absolutely wide open because you're scared to death. You think you're going to die. So you're in survival mode. And one by one, people are getting plucked out of that water as they're not making it.
And when what I thought was so impressive was, you know, you have that underwater blackout. They pull you out. They revive you. And then they give you a choice.
You have the choice to continue training, which means you get thrown back in the water, or you're out of the program and you're gone and you get shipped back off. You don't even get to start the training. So immediately you start to understand, are you resilient? Resiliency is something that can be trained. Are you resourceful? And it's not important how you're going to get through things. It's why you're going to get through things. So I had no clue. I wasn't some collegiate swimmer coming from a water polo background or some swim team. I was just the guy that just wanted to make it. So there I was scrambling to figure out, okay, I'm just going to figure out how to make it. And then you start to see that you actually are resilient. And then because of the leverage of the situation, you rise to the occasion. And it looks ugly. It doesn't look like it looks like on TV. It doesn't look like, it doesn't sound like what we read in books. You feel like you're failing, and yet you're winning. And you look like, just, it looks disgusting. You know, you're scrambling, you're crying, you're hanging on for dear life, and yet that's what winning is. And by the end of it, you get through something like that. You can't see for days because of, you know, being in the water for 12 hours with no goggles. You have to sleep for 2 days. And then you walk around like you're a war hero, because thousands of people that understand the context of what it is you went through, they look at you like, oh my gosh, like, you actually made it through that. So then you're a walking hero in the community with the thousands of other people. Then you start the training on Monday. Then you start the training. And then you start to see, oh, I see. So this whole hero thing and this bravery context, and those things, they're not real. That's not what we're supposed to do biologically. Nobody's brave. Instinctively, you run. If you have a threat, you either fight or you flight. If you don't do one of those things, you go into helplessness and you freeze. There is no bravery. So in that context, in that situation in the pool, I was feeling completely overwhelmed. I was completely useless. I was just surviving. And then yet I was achieving and I was succeeding. So I was like, what does this mean exactly? And all it was a way to clean out house. So they didn't have to spend the time training all these people that weren't trainable in the first place.
Right, because they didn't know how to manage themselves and they didn't have that level of clarity.
Now they actually have a test, and they do that through, I'm not sure if it's done across all of the different the services, but they have a test for neuropeptide Y. Neuropeptide Y you can test with a blood test. So Hunter's going to go in and wants to be a recon Marine. They would just take a blood test. And if you have higher levels of neuropeptide Y, generally it means that you're going to respond the way that you need to respond to do that type of work. It means that if a car crash happens, you're going to have less chance of being in shock than someone who doesn't have higher neuropeptide Y. Wow. You're going to have less acute stress reaction. You're going to thrive when someone else is just surviving. We can just test for that now. So instead of spending all that time and money and...
Yeah, but isn't it more fun to throw you in the pool for 12 hours?
I think it's more fun to throw someone in the pool for 12 hours. So I generally default to these things when it comes to training or fitness or health, is I look at it from a function standpoint. Is this system developed? Can we develop it? And then let's test this thing. It's designed to be tested. It's designed to work well.
And that really is that military mindset, where it's not, you know, oh, how good do you look? It's like, what can you do?
I haven't looked in the mirror in like 20 years, Hunter. So it's always been about function.
Right.
It is interesting. And then as a byproduct, my health, I do really well. You could look generally, if you listen to all the stuff I've done, which is a lot physically, you would say, well, he's got to be really, the system has to be really degenerated. There must be a lot of pain. My body does really well. And I've taken care of it, focusing on function, not necessarily on vanity.
Well, and I think that's the big key. If there's one takeaway from this whole podcast, you know, just sort of as a starter to warm people up. It's that distinction between vanity and function. So you can ask, how much do you lift, bro? Do you even lift? And maybe you can, I mean, you know, we've not just those five bodybuilders, but there are a lot of people who come in here who sort of look the part. You're like, man, the muscles are all puffed up. They look like a giant peacock.
Right. Function is generally low.
Yeah.
Function is low. That's that ego versus mastery orientation.
And it's the same right. thing. That's what the kickboxing teacher's talking about. That's very much what, you know, the Marine Corps is about. That's very much what the Rewire Project is about, is, okay, great. Is your body able to perform in the ways that you want and need it to perform?
We want to feel good. We want to have reliability in it.
Right.
We need to have reliability in it.
And that's what you, it's the same thing with cars. I mean, you've used this car analogy before. There's the car that is, you know, souped up, looks amazing and all of this stuff, but actually doesn't work very well.
Right.
I mean, my dad had this Jaguar. And it was, I mean, you know, this was a car that was like, wow, it looks so cool. It's a Jaguar. It has that neat little thing on the front with a Jaguar. And, oh, amazing. But it was... But it was always in the shop. And then also it was a two-seater car. And we lived in England. So even though it was a convertible, you always had to have the roof up because it was cold. So there I am in the back bench. It's not even a seat. The back bench, you know, folded over. like some sort of, you know, marionette. And it was a terrible car. It was right. not functional. Would have much rather had a Ford Taurus.
Right.
Or, you know, something much more boring.
Right.
So the question is, functionality is, you know, that's what we're really aiming for in terms of, I think, a lot of this mixed mental arts. You know, do you have an understanding of how your brain works and how your body works that is functional? Are you able to do what you want to do? Are you able to achieve what you want to achieve? Is it practical?
Most people can't. Most people don't have reliability in their body, and then they come to have that be, that's what they expect. They get accustomed to that.
Yep. And so what, this is just to introduce one more voice, Tony Molina, but we're obviously very open. I know that a lot of people in the community have nutrition experts that they like or fitness experts that they like. And we're open to all of that. And what we really want is that intellectual thunderdome. And this is very much Tony's mindset. Let all the ideas battle each other out. And let's find what's the best understanding. Let's evolve the best culture that we've yet seen. So Tony is very much up for this, I think.
It's a movement.
Yeah.
We're in a movement.
See, I just have other associations once you start talking about movements. But that's the Dutchman in me. All right, ladies and gentlemen, on that very profound and elevated note, I'm glad I've totally lowered the tone of the conversation. This has been Hunter Motz and Tony Molina of the Rewire Project. It's very good to have you in the dojo.
It's been good to be here.
Yeah.